Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Obama and Romney lay out divergent paths to peace as a tribute to our war dead on Memorial Day. Did you hear it? Or at least they had different kinds of rhetoric. We will hear some clips and talk to David Sanger from the New York Times about the contrast between Romney and Obama to begin today. And then we'll take calls from Vietnam veterans on the lessons of the war as you see them now, as the president kicked off a remembrance of the Vietnam War yesterday on the symbolic 50th anniversary of the start of that war. David Sanger is the New York Times chief Washington correspondent and a WNYC contributor and has a book coming out next week called Confront and Conceal, Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American Power. Hi, David. Thanks for doing this today.
Great to be back with you.
So Memorial Day was a day when President Obama and his challenger Mitt Romney both said their speeches were to honor our war dead, not political. But the contrast between them, at least in language, was stark and I think intentional on both their parts. So here is a clip that's probably making the most news, a full-throated Romney on being the biggest, baddest gun in the West.
We have two courses we could follow. One is to follow in the pathway of Europe, to shrink our military smaller and smaller to pay for our social needs. And they, of course, rely upon the strength of America, and they hope for the best. Were we to follow that kind of course, there'd be no one that could stand to protect us. The other is to commit to preserve America as the strongest military in the world, second to none, with no comparable power anywhere in the world.
Thump, thump, thump. David, why did he go there in a Memorial Day speech?
Well, it plays to an important element of the Republican base, this argument that the United States is cutting into its military power in order to pay, as he said, for social programs. Well, there are a couple things that have happened, you know, in between. I mean, since 2001, since 9/11, the military budget has roughly doubled. And, of course, we've been spending extraordinarily heavily on both Iraq and Afghanistan, two wars that were not supposed to cost very much but ended up costing together well over $1 trillion. And, of course, because of health care, the veterans and so forth, those costs are going to continue to be rising for some time long after the fighting is done.
And, of course, everybody in America thinks it was worth not paying more for social programs in order to fight the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, right?
Well, you know, there's a fascinating moment that I describe in Confront and Conceal where the president is trying to price the Pentagon's program for going in and doing a counterinsurgency in Afghanistan over 10 years. And Peter Orszag, the head of the Office of Management and Budget, who's been handed the Pentagon's war plan, comes in to see the president and says, well, if you did this plan exactly as the Pentagon handed it to you, it would be about $1 trillion over 10 years. And this was 2009, which, Mr. President, is about the cost of insuring every uninsured American over the same period of time. And, you know, these are real trade-offs. There are trade-offs between how you spend at home and how you spend on wars. And so that doesn't mean you shouldn't spend any money on military action, but it does mean you want to make your choices very carefully.
Obama, for his part, yesterday spoke at the Tomb of the Unknowns at Arlington National Cemetery, as presidents often do, and at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. His tone and substance were very different from what we just heard from Romney. Listen.
After a decade under the dark cloud of war, we can see the light of a new day on the horizon. Especially for those who've lost a loved one, this chapter will remain open long after the guns have fallen silent.
So what strikes me, David, is that here we are on the 50th anniversary of the start of the Vietnam War, and nothing much has changed, at least in the rhetoric, between Democrats talking about peace and the cost of war and Republicans talking about a big military as the path to, peace through strength in a presidential campaign.
Well, you know, it does strike you, Ryan, that a lot of this conversation seems stuck back in a pre-Afghanistan, pre-Iraq era. It strikes me the more interesting conversation is the one about whether or not what President Obama has adopted, and which some in the Bush administration had argued for before and after 9/11, which is a light footprint strategy, makes significantly more sense. Now, what is that light footprint strategy? It's a strategy that says we don't go in and occupy countries if we can possibly avoid it. We don't go in and do big ground wars. We use drones. We use cyber. We use special forces. We go in quickly and we get out quickly. Think Libya, for example. Now, there are downsides to that as well, because you're not around to go rebuild societies. But there's a huge, huge cost differential. And the question is that a smarter use of American power? And it strikes me that the conversation that we're sort of headed toward, if you just took the Memorial Day speeches that you heard from both candidates, but particularly from Mitt Romney, it's of an older image of how one uses American military force.
Yeah, if one has lived long enough, one could find this whole presidential campaign kind of boring in the respect that they're arguing about how big a military buildup we should have for the present world. And they're arguing about the size of government and the size of entitlements.
But how big is, you know, Brian, isn't the right question. The right question is what kind? You know, for example, President Obama decided, whether he's right or wrong, not to approve a Pentagon proposal for a standing force of 100,000 troops for stability operations last year. Because he said, we don't want to be doing Iraq and Afghan-like stability operations. Mm-hmm. That's not where we're intended. I'd rather use the money for other things, both military and non-military. The pivot to Asia, for example. That strikes me as the more interesting debate, and one in which Romney, Governor Romney, could make some, you know, could score some interesting points against the president. But it's not just a big or small.
But the title of your book, Confront and Conceal: Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American Power, does that indicate that Obama has spoken like a dove but acted like a hawk?
Certainly, what I discovered as I traveled around the world, talked to Americans and others who are posted around the world who've been at the front edge of this, is that the president has been far more aggressive than anybody would have expected if you listened to him during the 2008 campaign. He's, you know, the drones are an obvious example, and the Times has a very long story on page one of the paper today about how the president has sort of personally taken over the decision making on the drones war, in the drone wars. Cyber is another fascinating example along these lines, so the question here is he making different use of new American weapons? And I think the book is all about how he has done so and how he's tried to rewrite the Obama doctrine to fit these new technologies.
Now, you talk about traveling around the world and what you hear. Here's a clip, and this goes to the big versus small question, not to the how question. But this is former President Carter from our show recently as part of the series we're doing called End of War. When I asked him if humans could abolish war, and listen to what he said about perceptions of the United States.
Nowadays, unfortunately, my wife and I have been to more than 130 countries, and now when we travel around doing work for the Carter Center, it's generally accepted that the most intense warmonger for the last 35 or 40 years has been the United States of America. We're the country that's in the forefront of almost every war that started.
And he's talking about, and he clarified this later, perceptions of the United States. This is not him saying this, but what he's hearing is that the United States is seen as the biggest warmonger in the world over the last 35 or so years, and that somewhat has to do with what Romney was talking about, that the United States has a much bigger military than the rest of the world combined and isn't afraid to use it in what it perceives as the longer-term interests of peace.
Well, that is certainly the perception of the U.S., but then you get the flip side of it, and you see this with Syria right now, which is people stepping in and saying, where is the United States using its air power, using its technology to stop a war that's being committed by a dictator against his own people? So in some cases, we have gone in issues of self-defense. That's Afghanistan. In some cases, we have gone in on the basis of false evidence. That's Iraq. In some cases, we have gone in under the relatively new theory of that there is a responsibility to protect. And that was Libya, and it's the debate about Syria. So now, of course, to many people around the world, these distinctions don't mean a whole lot. They all look like American power. To us here at home, they do mean a lot. And, you know, why you go in is as important as how you go in. And that's one of the great debates. And a good deal of the reason that I wrote this book, Confront and Conceal, was to try to tease out what the Obama administration's philosophy is here about military intervention, because, as you say, it has been very aggressive.
Can I ask you, by the way, about Syria before we run out of time? This is, of course, very much in the news today. For people who weren't following news much over the Memorial Day weekend, there was a massacre in Hulu, Syria, of more than 100 people, as it's being reported. Dozens of them are said to have been children under 10, the victims, and a lot of women as well. And now countries around Europe are taking serious diplomatic action. Britain's foreign ministry says the UK is expelling three Syrian diplomats over these civilian deaths. Italy also, Syrian ambassador not welcome following massacre of civilians, some other places in Europe. Why is this happening now, and what choices does the U.S. have in terms of its response to this?
Well, this has been going on for, as we've discussed on past shows, more than a year now, Brian. The Syrian rebellion was among the first in the Arab Spring. And the big question is there an effective diplomatic response? Well, the U.S. has tried and failed on that, and so have many others. There's been the Kofi Annan peace plan. And now the question has come back, question that never really went away, which is there a Libya-like intervention that is possible? And the answer to the question is, it's a whole lot more complicated than in Libya. In Libya, you could see Muammar Gaddafi's forces gathering in the desert before they got into many of these towns, and they could be bombed before they got there. In the case of Syria, you have a much better trained, much larger, more disciplined army, and they are in the midst of these towns, and there's no way to go in from the air without killing a lot of civilians. And that means going in on the ground, and that's a very, very different and much more casualty-ridden proposition, and something that many are not ready for, starting with the Russians.
So in the context of the campaign, is there any difference between Romney and Obama on Syria?
There is some. You heard Governor Romney say over the weekend that he would arm the rebel groups in Syria. Sounds good until you dig down and you try to figure out who these rebel groups are, and you discover that they're not one unified force, but there are many different tribes and groups that have come together and in some cases split apart. And one of the concerns is that if you give them lethal weaponry, they end up turning it on each other and you end up with a civil war. Now, some people would say, well, let's just try that and worry about it once Assad is gone. But, you know, we've discovered in places like Afghanistan that if you arm rebels willy-nilly, you discover later on, maybe 10 years later in the case of Afghanistan, that some of that weaponry is being used against American forces. And that's taught people in the military to be a little bit cautious about it.
And before you go, a Gallup poll shows Romney with about a 20-point lead among veterans. And that was much bandied about, you know, yesterday being Memorial Day. But does that reflect something about his military policy, something that veterans in particular like? Or I'm wondering if that's just the fact that most vets are still white men, Romney's strongest demographic group, and they lean the same way as white men who are not vets.
Well, I think there's a little bit of both going on. I think that while President Obama has developed something of a special bond with the special forces, people who went in after bin Laden and have been used in so many of these other light footprint operations. He still has a hard time with a lot of the mainstream military and certainly with the veterans. Some of that is don't ask, don't tell. Some of that is a reflexive sense that Democrats are less willing to use American hard power. And part of that is that the president's own strategy has been one of trying to cut back some on the traditional military and focus on where the United States has a technological advantage. And that's frequently a difficult thing to explain to vets who are accustomed to an older style military.
And by the way, this just came across. The U.S. has now joined Germany, Spain, Italy, France, Britain, Canada, and Australia in expelling Syrian diplomats after the Hula massacre. How do we get out of that? Does this now mean diplomatic relations are informally suspended with the Syria government until something changes? How big a deal is this if the U.S. is expelling Syrian diplomats?
You know, there hasn't been much diplomatic exchange anyway except at the level of Kofi Annan and these other missions from the U.N. going directly to Syria. Nobody seems to believe that any of these Syrian diplomats have any decision-making capability or even being particularly consulted by Assad. In the end, this is about Assad and the group around him, who are almost all Alawites, in running a country that is largely Sunni. And that's part of the difficulty here, because they know that they are fighting for their own survival. If Assad is gone, the Alawites are gone as well. And so that's why there's all this discussion about trying to find a way, as in Yemen, of removing him in a more peaceful way. Not sure that's going to work.
David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times and a WNYC contributor and author of a book now called Confront and Conceal, Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American Power. David, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Brian.